This is Art Talk and I'm Sean O'Brien. I'm at the National Trust S.H. Irvine Gallery to view the exhibition John R. Walker, Journey Through Landscape. And I'm going to be talking to the artist. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon.
Now, John, the first feelings that I had walking through this room is that to be in a large room full of large landscape paintings, it's a fairly, it's almost a luxurious experience. I would equate it with a fantastic bushwalk. You know, there's something you can really delve into the landscape and feel as if you are in the bush in a way. And I understand that bushwalking is important, an important part of your own experience.
Yeah, I've been really, since I was a tiny child, going bush, walking around in places has been a major thing for me. And I think one of the underlying things of what I've been trying to do for a very long time is make pictures which are about not looking at something but walking around, being in it. And if they've developed, it's really from there, you know. Because it's a bit like the difference between looking at a glass of wine or a photograph of a glass of wine and actually drinking it. What I want to try and make is the experience of drinking it, not looking at it.
The other thing is that this is, I guess there's about 10 years worth of work in this exhibition. I guess that makes you stop and take stock of what you've been doing in your life. You know, to become an artist is a risk, it's a gamble. Why did you take that gamble?
I'm not any good at anything else. I wish I had it with me. There's the first page of the Japanese poet Basho's Journey to the Deep North basically says it beautifully. But you know, I'm a poet because I can't do anything else. Actually, the other one, lovely one is somebody who was talking to Degas once and said, you must come and see my show, Watercolours. You might find the frames a bit rich, but after all, we are makers of luxury goods. To which Degas turned and said, well, they might be luxury goods to you, mate, but to me, they're necessities. Yeah. And that's about it, yeah.
And how long has landscape been your passion?
Well, it's a funny thing. I mean, really, ever since I was a wee child. But really, you know, it wasn't until I was about 38 and I started to really accept that it was my given subject. I think, you know, I'd internalised the idea that contemporary art or whatever could be almost anything except for landscape, you know, and it was only really about that time that I, you know, initially with certain desperation and then with, I guess, an increasing sense of confidence, realised it was my patch, my paddock, you know.
What was the breakthrough moment? Was it actually being out in the landscape, in the bush, or was it also influence coming from the art that you saw around you?
It was a bit of both. I mean, there is something really wonderful about being out in the paddocks with a billy, some Chinese paper or whatever, gouache, and, you know, just wandering around and painting pictures. And then this is towards the end of the time I was teaching at the National Art School. We had a class in transcriptions and we went down to Agnes and lo and behold, they'd taken down every painting that was on the list, you know, so I was desperately looking for things before they wandered off to the coffee shop. And I happened to stand in front of Streeton's Fison, which I hadn't really looked at for years, you know. And it was a bit of a sort of, you know, Proust Madeleine sort of moment. The painting just suddenly sang like I wouldn't believe. All these memories and smells of childhood came to me, and also the realization that this was one hell of a tough picture, you know, that this was really interesting. I think started to make me realize that there was this whole territory that had been largely abandoned that actually was really, really interesting.
And there was something in that Streeton painting that took you back to those experiences as a child in the bush.
Yeah, I mean, this funny sort of quality, I mean, the incredible sense of frontiality, I could smell it, you know, the smell of smoke, that amazing sky. I mean, Streeton and Nolan are the only two people I can think of that can get that quality of, like, intense blue, but like, it's not pretty, it's got a quality of almost lead about it, you know, that, like, you can pick a street in both sky, and it's the same as Nolan, like, that, you know, that blue, you know.
A lot of landscape artists, once they you know, make that final leap into wanting to totally embrace landscape as a crucial part of their art, often adopt an area. It seems that you've adopted the area of Braidwood in New South Wales. Can you tell us a little bit about why the attraction to the Braidwood area?
Well, to some extent, it was chance. After doing the residency at Bundanon, I started to realise that it was getting ridiculous to sort of have to go off somewhere for 6 weeks, come back to Parramatta Road and all that, and that also my wife wanted to stop working and go to university, and that if we moved out of Sydney, we could afford to do that sort of thing, you know, and also be a lot closer to what was obviously my main interest, you know. And Braidwood was really, well, it just happened to happen, really, you know. And when I first moved there, I didn't quite know what to take. How to take it, because I'd mostly been painting sort of relatively, not natural, but relatively bush. And this Braidwood is actually in the centre of a big granite plateau, and in fact, you know, is grazing country. It's the opposite of what Les Murray in a lovely poem calls the never fenced country, which is what I was used to. You could just wander, you know, you can go to the Butterwangs and just take off, you know, not worry about tracks even, you know. So I wasn't really sure what I'd do with it, actually, to be honest. But I just thought, well, I've got to have a go, you know, and also, like, I was at that time about 43, 44, I think, and I was aware that really, you know, if I didn't sort of get some sort of thing together in the next 5-6 years, I'd be getting too bloody old, you know. I mean, there are limits to, you know, what you can do. And so we moved there, and it sort of turned out to be really fantastic, because it's almost got, like, apart from desert, it's almost got everything, you know, the high flat granite country, which actually is full of wreckage for the last 200 years, really, you know. And then on the edges of it, like at Monga and so on, there is the wild country. At Monga, there's the cloud forests of plumwood, Eucryphia morii, that have been there for about 60 million years, and a, you know, cold wet rainforest. There's the Butterwangs wilderness, you know, there's areas like that. There's the dry, almost Sydney-like sort of ridges around the Great Divide west of us. There's Tantillion Creek, which feels a bit like one of the little valleys at Wollumbai, you know. And actually a lot of it's within 1 hour on a bicycle. Yeah, so, and then the town itself has actually turned out to be, I mean, it's an interesting place, but, you know, we're not too far from the city, and, you know, because it's the only town for a very long way, we actually have a lot of services. We have 2 banks, we have ambulance, police, you know, so it's not like we're cut off, and the community has a lot of quite interesting people, like so Roger McDonald, the author, you know, but it's also not a suburb like Springwood, you know. It's a real farm country. It's a working town. Yeah.
You mentioned before that you did a residency at Bundanon, which of course is the a couple of residencies there,
yeah.
Which is the Arthur Boyd property.
Pulpit Rock.
Yeah. So
Mr. Floppy and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. In a way, it's a loaded landscape.
Oh, so however, I mean, like, yeah, I was invited to be an artist in residence there, and I went there in winter of 2001, and I remember, like, going into the place, you know, and thinking, what am I going to do with this? You know, I mean, you got black swans, you got, you know, all the rest of it, and it's funny, but, like, firstly, there's something about the spirit about the place, you know, that felt very generous, and then actually, in a funny sort of way, it was above a challenge, but then also in a way deeply satisfying that you could approach something, I could approach something like this and make something of my own out of it. I guess it confirmed to me something, you know, like it did give me the ambition that I needed to have my own, not Bundanon, yeah, but my own place. Mm. And that it was actually something that if I could do that, I could possibly do something. I wasn't quite sure what, but, you know, so that's sort of what led me to take what really, in retrospect, was a fairly large gamble of leaving Sydney and, you know, the whole thing, you know. Yeah.
Let's just have a look at this painting over here, which is painted at Bundanon.
6 days of Bundanon, and I give thanks to Boyd. It is, of course, a bit of a sort of piss take on Colin McCann, you know. I mean, I've always been fascinated by sort of multi-sequential fugue-like forms, right? And yeah, there is that beautiful Colin McCann of the 6 Days in Canterbury, you know. And Bundanon actually the first time I went there was really the first time I managed to pull something off the 5 meter long one, which is a sort of fugue-like form. It's a walk along a ridge. It's not a panorama, and yet it does hold together as a sort of journey, you know. And this was one of the ones that I did towards the end when I was feeling fairly relaxed, and it was really, I just thought, well, I'll just paint six panels on the one canvas, you know, of basically the same ridge across the Shoalhaven, you know, and just see what happens. So that's, you know, really, that it really, you know.
And in a painting like this, to what extent are you drawing on sketches that you've created in the field? To what extent are you actually looking at the view while you paint it? Or to what extent are you drawing on memory?
Well, it's sort of all of them. I mean, my sort of pretty standard way of working is I'll go out to places. Like, you know, I've got little stations, if you like, set up on friends' properties, etc. these days. I'll go out there and spend a day or two doing gouaches or the big Chinese folding books or walk around the place. You know, I don't ever really do look and put, right? My method, it's a bit of a variation on Nolan, actually. You know, I like to walk around, look at things, and then come back to the table and quickly, very quickly, just put down whatever it is, my immediate response. Leave it, at the end of the day, pile them all up, take them back to the studio, you know, cook dinner, have some beers, look at it, you know, and throw them out, you know. And what it's about really is, if you do enough of that, you start to internalise it, you know. And at some point it gets to some sort of thing where it's no longer something you're separate from, it's you. Right? And that's where you can start to then go into the studio and try and do the big machine, you know. So there's a bit of everything about it, you know.
Once you get to work on a large canvas like this, is it unfolds until you've completed it, or do you work on several at once?
I feel a bit like, you know, it's a bit, painting for me is a bit like a sort of almost a computer algorithm by now. You collect all this data and you sort of go out and you sort of fiddle around things and look at stuff, and then you sort of like load it all in, press the button, and it does the thinking, if you know what I mean. And what comes out often, if you're lucky, is completely unexpected, you know. But obviously there's a lot of intentional stuff in terms of getting it all together. But then the process itself is the thinking. You know, the making is, there is nothing else.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and the form is the content. You know, there is nothing else.
Are you still drawing on very specific skills, artistic skills, or have you almost moved beyond that?
I don't know if I've ever had any, you know, to be honest. I'll leave that to other people to. I mean, look, sorry, I'm not quite sure what you mean, actually. You know.
Yeah. Do you reach a point where you don't even have to think about the nuts and bolts? You just know how to go for it.
It depends, you know. I mean, some days are complete fuck-ups, and, you know, then there's, if you're lucky, every now and then. It's like, you know, Guston once said, you know, you start off in the studio and it's full of all these people, you know, parents and dealers and critics and God knows, and then gradually they all leave, and then there's just you and painting. And then if you're really lucky, you leave and there's just painting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, you can't... It's the great paradox about spontaneity and creation and all that is you can't do it. Yeah. I mean, you certainly can't consciously do it. You can't deliberately be spontaneous. Yeah. It's just one of those things that if you're lucky, you know, at some point, you know, you forget what you for at least for half an hour or something. It's like grace. You know, I mean, it's funny, yeah, the Buddhist concept and the Christian concepts, that I can't remember the Buddhist label, but, you know, grace is this thing that just happens by definition. You know, it's like enlightenment, actually. You know, it obviously requires work and effort, but in the end, it's by definition, it's something that just happens.
Yeah.
You know, it's not deserved, it's not earned in a way. You know, it just falls from heaven like fine rain. Mm. You know.
As a spectator of art, I'll often look at a painting, for example, this one, the 6 days at Bundanon. And, you know, I have no idea how long that would have taken you. You know, is there a certain period that you like to work at a canvas?
Basically, most pictures, if they don't come off in basically one day, it's, you know, that's it. You know, I tend to spend a lot of time brooding, not so much about a picture, but about a subject or a place. You know, I've spent a lot of time wandering around. I mean, the erosion gullies at Bedevale, you know, that have been a recurring subject for a long time now. I must have spent probably months in total walking around, thinking, drawing, looking, trying to even understand them. You know, actual paintings of them might take an hour, you know, or might take 2 days, or I don't know. I think you've got to bear in mind also, the bigger the picture, the quicker you have to paint. It's like Delacroix once said, if you can't draw a man in the time it takes him to fall from the third floor of a building, you can't do the big machines. You know, if you're going to do this sort of things like the death of Sardanapalus, which is the size of a tennis court, you have to be fucking bold. You know, small miniatures you can take years on.
Yeah.
Big pictures have to be done. They have to have a nonchalance about them.
Yeah, sure.
There's nothing worse than a fussed over big picture. Yeah.
Let's go from the big to the smaller. One of the artist's books that you've got here in this cabinet. Tell us about the process of creating an artist book like this.
This one is a friend's place called Tantulium Creek. This particular one, I spent a few hours walking up and down this little valley, which is a deep, beautiful little place. I then came back to the veranda of their house, which is down there, you can see. And from memory, whatever you call it, did the book, as from memory of walking along it. So it starts here, which is really the very top end of the valley with a little ridge with the trees behind it, then down into the valley and looking up, and then sort of up behind their house looking at the forested ridge. The rest of the book's a bit hidden, but the next one is actually the little line of hill with the green water tank up the top, you know, and so on. So it's basically just trying to put down the experience of walking in something. So it's sort of sequential, but it's also a totality. In terms of how I structure things, I've for years had this thing about fugue, where, you know, you have anything up to 5, 6, 7 musical themes, if you like, or tunes, you know, that are then woven together, and almost like simultaneously, but not quite, you either hear them as separate, distinct things, or you hear some sort of weird totality of them. And I think it's a really interesting way of trying to construct representations of experience, because experience is like that, you know, I think, anyway. Yeah.
And would you regard an artist's book like this as a work unto itself? So it's not just a means to an end of a large canvas.
I never do like studies in that direct sense, you know. I think until you can get to the point where it's basically a place is inside you, imagined, and then you paint what's inside you, really, you know. No good. Plus, like, to be honest with you, like, my favourite medium, my favourite thing to do, really, is decidedly Chinese. I mean, there's something about nice paper, a long, springy, touchy brush, kneeling, you know, a cup of tea. It's got an immediacy and touch about it that's the best. Yeah, by comparison, the big oils, the big machines, which I love doing, but this stuff is like driving a really nice racing car, whereas the big paintings, it's, you know, it's a lot more work. You know, there's more calculation that has to be. You know, the sense of achievement's great, but there's something about, you know, that sense of, you know, I mean, you can understand why some of those Chinese guys love to go up in the mountains, you know, and paint and drink, and, you know, there's something about it that's like so good for the soul.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I'd like to have a look at one of the earlier paintings of the Braidwood area.
Yeah.
And then go to one of the later ones.
Mm-hmm.
Just tell us the name of this work.
This is the Dry Dam. This really goes
2004.
Yeah, so in fact, it actually really goes to the first year in Braidwood. It was a period, of course, where Braidwood, like most of eastern Australia, was in the grips of very severe drought, and there was a dam up on top of the hill not far from where my painting sort of station table is, that was particularly dry and had this pretty poisonous looking toxic sort of greeny grey mud at the bottom, which gradually dried out and cracked. I painted it, tried to make a sign of I know, I mean, the thing that strikes me a lot of these places is, yeah, that there are often these odd combinations of both really quite beautiful and yet also, like, in the end, like, pretty scary, you know, or damaged. It's a bit like if you just innocently look at some, you know, really swampy, oil-filled, crappy place in an innocent way, you can think, what pretty colours on the water, but in fact it's an oil spill or something, you know. Mm. And I guess this was the period where I was first sort of coming to terms with this landscape, you know, which was really quite out there compared to what I'd been working in. You know, it was certainly not like wandering around in the wilderness in the Butterwings or something, you know. Mm. It's a picture I'm quite fond of, actually.
What interests me looking at it straight off is kind of large expanses that are flat-ish, mm, and then highly concentrated areas where the paint is really built up to the extent that it's really coming off the canvas.
Yeah, well, I mean, content is basically form, right? I mean, unless you believe in ghosts or something, you know, there's no, like Blake said, there's body and soul are one and the same thing, you know. There's no body, there's no soul, it just is. And with painting, right, I mean, there are a number of basic things, variations, if you like, that you can construct content out of. And flat, thick, bright, dark, strong colour, weaker colour, they're used to a range of stuff. So, you know, a fundamental thing, particularly a lovely thing with oil paint, is that zap between virtually empty and intensely concentrated. You know, it's part of the repertoire, if you like, a range of notes that you've got to construct some sort of thing from, you know. So, and apart from that, I've always really loved time. I mean, the painters probably that mean the most to me in terms of, like, just the way I paint would be Goya and Manet, I suppose, you know, Fred to some degree. But, you know, and that touch thing, that lovely thing which is endlessly fascinating about painting, that you can have something which is at both same time, a lump paint and sort of a tree, and yet neither. Mm. That's when it hangs, that sense of, like, you know, just hovering on the edge of, you know, I think a central part of what art's about. And it's one of the most important things about art, in a way, is making you aware of the fact that when you look at something, what you're really looking at is, even when you're looking at something, is a representation. It's something your mind has constructed. The one thing about constructed sort of representations is they can make you aware in a funny sort of way of the fact that you are aware.
I've noticed that you are walking that kind of tightrope in most of the paintings of mm-hmm. how many marks can you create or how few marks can you put on you know, you have what you need.
Yeah, and it's really, you know, look, I don't know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it's that nice sense of edge, you know. I mean, you wouldn't want to do something if it didn't have a distinct possibility of failure, you know, wouldn't be worth it, you know.
Let's have a look at this one just around the corner, which is very recent.
Yes.
Ridge Walking, 2008.
Yeah.
And this is one where there's something quite different going on here in terms of there is a lot of expanse of emptiness and some very bold marks, and we have the sense of ridge walking.
I think the main thing is, I mean, if you keep doing something for long enough, you know, you get more confident about it, you know, and you gradually get at least a bit, you know, in between sort of drinks or whatever, a bit clearer about what you're doing. And I suppose by now I feel more confident about letting it all show. You know, and also, I think, see, I've now got a studio which is 15 metres by 5.5 metres, right? And, you know, I can also, like, instead of, like, years ago, overdo things, I can step out the front door and go and dig a hole in the veggie patch or go and cook some food or go for a walk. So that when I was 30, I was always bloody wrecking things. You know, do something and then, you know, rather than walk away, I'm not sure, you know. Whereas now it's you know, it's probably the only consolation of being decrepit is that you, yeah, you can, you know what I mean? Like you can actually just go, oh, fuck it, I'll go and plant some cabbages or something, yeah, or I'll go and cook dinner, yeah. And you come back and realise, oh, hang on, that's actually there, yeah, it's about right, you know.
Yeah.
Apart from that, the other thing that's really happened for me in the last few years is I've hit upon a way of making the grounds for my pictures, which involves basically using a very strong gouache with some acrylic binder to make it stable, but it allows me to get these sort of grounds which have a certain sort of variation in luminosity about them, which is quite different to normal, and it gives you a similar quality to, you know, Robert Thomas's pictures, you know,
yeah,
which were basically ground up ochres with, yeah, orchid juice, right? And
yeah,
gouache is not that dissimilar because it's ground up ochres and the like with gum acacia and a bit of binder or whatever. They have a certain sort of density of pigment which gives them a sort of zing, and it does mean, like, for instance, in the, like the right hand panel here, that you can actually do a lot of your initial, like, almost construct the space before you even start actually really putting the paint on, you know.
Do you mean the base that you're working on top of, is
yeah,
it, yeah,
which is sort of constructed? And I mean, increasingly my work, I like the Tantillion Creek and the Big Gully, I start by working out a particular rhythm, if you like, to divide on. I mean, it doesn't work all the time, but I find I can actually get a lot of the basic spatial construction done in that initial lay-in really quickly.
Okay.
Which, you know, like I said, gouache, that sort of stuff is, it's got a certain directness about it, which means also that the paint then can sort of work more like the singer and the soloist rather than have to be the whole band.
Right.
You know, the you know, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Apart from that, it's also just simply, like I said about Goya, I mean, if you, I've just recently for the first time been in like the Prado and stuff, and like particularly late Goya's, I mean, the incredible thing about Goya is the more spare and the more minimal there is, the more powerful. You know, I mean, the amazing thing about a lot of his late pictures, particularly the ones like the Dark Paintings, is, you know, a lot of my contemporaries and myself years ago would have, you know, they would have cooked it up like anything. He'd do something and, like, it, you know, it's a rape or whatever, but it's just so, like, held back, you know.
Mm.
Just a few touches, a few marks, you know. And, like, it's that thing, you know. It's a bit like food, too. Like, you know, it's got to be just really perfect, but also very simple.
Yeah.
If it's the right stuff, that's what it needs, you know. Yeah.
Just wanted to have a look at a couple of the paintings that have been created from the property that you've been working on recently. I wanted to have a look at the one of the cars, the car gully.
Yeah. It's a, what it is that's not one of it there. It's a gully at Biedervale. I'm not sure to what extent it is actually an accidental erosion gully and to what extent it was a deliberate gold mining erosion gully. Right?
So just to fill us in on Biedervale first.
Okay, Biedervale is a National Trust property. It's basically immediately south of the town. And because Braidwood's a very compact town, it's actually like literally I can walk out my front door. It's only about 200 yards to the boundary of the town and about another 1.5 km up the hill to where I paint, another 3 km to the house. It's a John Verge mansion. It's a truly remarkable place because it sort of was like a Sleeping Beauty. It was looked after between about 1900 and the current owners acquiring it in 1974, but basically no one changed anything. So there's rooms still with the original furniture, there's cupboards still with the driving gloves and goggles from 1910 or whatever, you know. So it's quite an amazing place, right? And then it used to be 20,000 or so hectares. It's now down to a few thousand, but the land around there does show, you know, mostly it's actually not the current owner so much as, you know, it goes back a long time of mismanagement, neglect, you know, it's a landscape of like mostly dead trees, and it's not that they cut them down, but no one thought to allow any regrowth, so when they all got to a certain age they all died, you know.
So it was sheep country, or is sheep
it
country?
It was sheep until, you know, wool collapsed. It's now basically beef breeding,
right.
And compared to a lot of Eastern Australia, it's still, we're reasonably okay. Like, our rainfall's dropped, but we haven't had the situation of simply not having rain, you know. But it's got a certain harshness to it, you know. I mean, it's beautiful as well, because you've got from the, it's fairly high, Bidderville, and you look south all the way down the Shoalhaven Valley towards Badger and the distant Kosciuszko, and, you know, it's quite, it's a weird combination of, like, you know, I was biking the other day and I stopped at one place because a friend was coming down the road with some eggs for me, actually, and, yeah, I was just looking, and, yeah, it's the most, it's one of the things I love about Nala and stuff, you know, and it's a funny sort of thing because the landscapes are so beautifully realised, and then, like, there's these absurd things going on in the foreground, you know, really, you know, there's this marvellous sense of just absurdity about the whole lot, you know. Except for, like, looking at this beautiful thing, and then, you know, just suddenly realise, like, all in front of you is just, like, corpses of trees, bits of tangled up barbed wire, dead cars or whatever, you know. It's such an emblem of Australia. Yeah, I mean, we're wonderful people. We have lovely coffee, and we're very sophisticated, and it's all built on a mountain of destruction. This gully is like about a kilometre long, anything up to 30 metres deep, full of wrecked cars in an attempt to sort of stop it eroding. You know, and it's quite fascinating because as you go down the gully, the cars get older. They start about 1970 and they finish about 1930. You know. And it's been a sort of what you call a motif or whatever of mine for quite some time, because it's just a fantastic sort of thing. And it also at times feels a bit like some sort of weird Chinese dragon or something, you know.
I mean, when you look at your landscapes, they're, particularly the ones you've been doing around Braidwood for the past 10 years, there is the hand of man in most of them.
Oh, yeah, the narratives. Yeah,
I mean, but in a way, you know, it's when you can put a car in to them, that's where it's getting quite obvious, yeah, that the hand of man is there.
This is the funny thing about it. I mean, a lot of this stuff, it takes time to actually see it, because it's awfully easy to take some of this stuff for granted, you know, that it's always been like that or whatever, you know. And it's also quite easy to just not even notice. I think most people, you know, they drive from Canberra to Batemans Bay and they just see, oh, it's a dead tree over there, you know, or they don't see it at all, you know. In fact, I feel like I don't paint landscape at all, really. You know, I'm not sure what I do, but it's more like history. It's more like some sort of... Again, Flannery is very important to me, because I think if you understand what he was talking about, the sort of way of looking that he's talking about with, say, the future readers, it's a history whose driving engines and approach is more science, ecology, than, say, economics or politics, you know. And for Australia, I think that's actually more fundamental, you know. But it is, in the end, a way of understanding time, history, space, whatever you call it. And history is this sort of residue of actions, you know, and it is superficial to look for hidden meanings. The mystery is in the visible, not the invisible. You know, so it's about looking really hard at things and realising, you know, this is actually a highly constructed landscape, you know.
John, in the 10 years that you've been creating the works that are hanging in this show, I guess landscape art in Australia has swung very much towards an attention towards Indigenous painters. How do you feel as a white artist taking on the Australian landscape?
I don't really think about that much. I mean, Indigenous artists, I mean, the gallery album we've actually, you know, represents a lot of Indigenous artists, and, yeah, and they certainly, I guess, have probably absorbed something in, but without even thinking about it. But I guess the one thing I really feel is that, like, I mean, it's fantastic stuff, and the desert and the wilderness is wonderful, but I think it's really important for mainstream Australia to actually come to grips with this itself. It's not good enough to sort of, like, delegate off the experience of landscape to, you know, somebody out of... It has to be brought right back into the lounge room.
John, congratulations on a fantastic show, and thanks for talking to us this afternoon.
Do you think it's all right?
I think it's great, yeah.